Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the 2013 Hollander Distinguished Lecture in Musicology. My name is Michael Largy. I'm the chair of the musicology program here at Michigan State. And before I ask my colleague, Dr. Marcy Ray, to come up and introduce today's speaker, I thought I would just say a few words about the sponsor for this program this afternoon, this third annual Distinguished Lecture in Musicology. This program is sponsored by the Hollander Endowment in Musicology, and the Hollander Endowment supports this distinguished lectureship, as well as funding student travel to conferences and for research purposes. We have a number of students who have benefited from that, actually here in attendance today several times. So it also sponsors musical performance that support the mission of musicology here at Michigan State. So the money that comes from the endowment helps our students and our program in a variety of ways. It was made by the generous support of the late Dr. Stanley Hollander and his wife Selma Hollander. Dr. Stanley Hollander was a university distinguished professor of business here at the Broad College of Business at Michigan State. And he passed away in 2004 after 32 years of service at MSU. And for anybody who's interested in a little Hollander trivia, you can go over to the third floor and see the Stanley Hollander Memorial Study Carol, which is actually right next to my carol. I wish I could get in there, but unfortunately I can't. But that's over there because he spent quite a bit of time doing work actually in that carol. So it actually has a plaque out on the third floor over there. He's survived by his wife of 47 years, Selma Hollander, who's with us this afternoon. Selma has a BA and an MA in studio art from Michigan State University, worked for the home economics department, now in the College of Human Ecology. Actually, I think it's moved one more time since then. For more than 50 years, both Stanley and Selma Hollander have been tireless supporters of the arts. Selma is still going to concerts on a regular basis. Is probably one of our most faithful concert attendees of all time. I think you probably set the record for that. They also, the Hollanders also have given generously, not only to the College of Music, but also to the Department of Art, Main Library, and other aspects of the arts, and we are all very, very grateful for their support. Really, this afternoon is not only a chance for us to come together and talk about issues in musicology, but it's also a chance to celebrate and to thank the Hollanders for their support of what we do. So please join me in a round of applause to thank Mrs. Hollander, who's with us here today. Now I'd like to ask my colleague, Dr. Marcy Ray, to come up and introduce today's speaker.
This past summer, I was attending a meeting of the International Meeting of the International Musicological Society, and it was in Rome. And I was giving a paper at which our speaker today was the panel chair. And after meeting him, I realized that not only is he a distinguished scholar, but he's also incredibly nice. And you would think that those two things aren't mutually exclusive, but they tend to be. If you've been to an AMS meeting, you'll see the very distinguished scholars, and they go down like a steamship, and the waves part, and people are backing up and trying to get out of their way. And when I realized that he was going to be spending this next year at the University of Michigan, I thought, this is a real opportunity for us to have someone who is a great scholar, but also a really kind person, because that's the kind of people that we want interacting with our students. So I feel that we're very lucky, and so you'll come to find out that he is really nice, but I'll tell you a little bit about his career. He did his PhD at the prestigious program of University of California at Berkeley, from which my own advisor graduated and several members of my committee. And he's now in Rochester, Minnesota, but he's spending the next year in Ann Arbor, so if you are intrigued, you can find him there. He's actually had quite a bit of teaching experience. He started at the University of Washington, went on, and not in this order, to University of Pittsburgh, University of Alabama, University of Houston, University of Texas at Austin, and did I miss anything? Colby as well. And so he's had quite a bit of teaching experience, which I think will again lend itself to the kind of quality that he will bring in this talk. He's received many awards from prestigious societies, including the Humboldt Society, the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as the American Philosophical Society. He has a number of books and extensive publications. If you want to know anything about opera in German-speaking lands in the late 18th century, he's the person you go to first. He's written about Haydn, Gossec, Hasse, Mozart, Salieri, Pergolesi, and even Palestrina, I noticed. So there are a number of publications that you can turn to, also several books. His most recent endeavor was a textbook for the music of the 18th century and includes an anthology, so it's something that is important for students. And there are a number of other publications, Mozart on the Stage, Salieri, and Viennese Opera, I think. Viennese Opera, and that's the one that won the King Goldie Award, which is the highest honor that the American Musicological Society gives for scholarship. So please enjoy and welcome our distinguished scholar, Professor John Rice.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Marcy, for the kind introduction, and thank you, Michael, for inviting me to Michigan State University. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all for being here. Europe's relatively peaceful and prosperous state after 1715 led to an increase in international travel. The nobility and upper middle class of Britain, Germany, and France went south to Italy, touring palaces and churches, visiting picture galleries, and sampling the local cuisine. Their travels, collectively, have come to be called the Grand Tour. Many professional musicians traveled around Europe as well, to enhance their skills, to make money, or to do both at once. The Grand Tour affected music in many ways. It broadened the taste of both musicians and patrons. It brought German, French, and British travelers into the theaters of Italy, not only supporting opera financially, but exposing many Italian singers and composers to potential employment north of the Alps. The travels of Italian musicians to Vienna, St. Petersburg, Berlin, and London were mirror images, so to speak, of the grand tours that their audiences had made to Italy. Among the most popular souvenirs that tourists brought home with them were musical scores. In this presentation, I'd like to present several case studies of grand tours that had important musical repercussions. I will limit myself mostly to the travels of amateur musicians and music lovers. But I'll conclude with a brief discussion of the travels of some professional musicians. I begin with a couple of examples of the Grand Tour in a more restricted sense than the one I used above, namely the travels of young British men of the nobility and upper middle class that they made as a kind of finishing school. After university studies, these young men, often accompanied by a tutor or chaperone, crossed the English Channel, spent a few weeks in Paris, then traveled on to Italy, visiting Venice, Florence, Rome, and Naples, before returning to Britain to take up the management of their estates or to begin careers in business, politics, or the church. London was 18th century Europe's largest and richest city. The Grand Tour, in this narrow sense of the term now, was one way in which London spent its great wealth. It used that wealth to buy access to, and in many cases actually to buy, the artistic, historical, and cultural riches of Italy. No single document better demonstrates this aspect of the Grand Tour than Johann Zoffany's painting of British tourists in the Tribuna, a room in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, which you have here. It portrays the Grand Tour really perfectly, I think, as a confrontation of British wealth and Italian artistic riches. Another painter is even more closely identified with the Grand Tour than Zoffany. In Rome, young Britons often had their portraits painted by Pompeo Battoni, the most expensive and sought-after portraitist in Italy. Battoni depicted John Montague rather atypically, without any trappings of Roman antiquity, but instead with a score of Corelli's violin sonatas, Opus 5, and an elaborately decorated mandolin under his arm. Montague was one of many music lovers and amateur musicians among the British tourists. Zoffany portrayed others in this well-known image of the Gore and Cowper families in Florence. George Clavering, Earl Cowper, had come to Italy as a young man. Here he is again, also portrayed by Zoffany. He fell in love with Florence and stayed there for the rest of his life. His grand tour ended early, or another way you could put it is that it never ended at all. A couple of examples of how British amateur musicians affected the course of music history. First, Thomas Osborne, the Duke of Leeds, arrived in Venice at the beginning of Carnival 1734. I should explain, throughout this paper when I use the term carnival, I mean the carnival opera season, which in most of Italy started the day after Christmas and continued all the way to the beginning of the day before Lent. In Venice, Leeds enjoyed the singing of one of the greatest male sopranos of the age, Farinelli. Leeds formed part of a coterie of Farinelli's British fans in Venice that included the Earl of Essex. Strongly drawn to the singer, Leeds organized his subsequent itinerary through Italy to see and hear as many of Farinelli's performances as possible in Venice, Vicenza, and Florence. He commissioned a poem in praise of Farinelli, while the Earl of Essex played a major role in negotiations that led to Farinelli's engagement by the Opera of the Nobility in London for the following season. Leeds, on his return to England near the beginning of 1735, became one of Farinelli's most generous patrons and friends. Tanto mio amico e patrone particolare is how he described is how Farinelli described Leeds. In his first London appearance in Artaserse, Farinelli sang Hassa's Per Questo Dolce Amplesso, which I'll play just an excerpt. Thank you. Farinelli's success in the performance of such music helped to make the 1735-1736 opera season in London a high point in the city's operatic history. Many years later, in 1780, the London music publisher Bremner issued a set of trio sonatas under the title 12 Sonatas for Two Violins and a Bass, or an orchestra, composed by Giovanni Battista Pergolesi. The attribution was doubted already in the 18th century and was definitely rejected in the 20th, but not before Stravinsky, in Pulcinella, reworked several movements and, in doing so, identified them indelibly with Pergolesi and himself. More recently, some of the sonatas have surfaced in manuscripts with attributions to one Domenico Gallo, on the basis of which the whole set has been tentatively attributed to Gallo. The publication of this music in London was a product of the Grand Tour. Bremner's title page informed prospective buyers, and you can see this here, the manuscript of these sonatas were procured by a curious gentleman of fortune during his travels through Italy. If true, this manuscript was one of hundreds brought back from Italy by British travelers, many of them now preserved in the British Museum. Let's listen to just a little bit. This music will be familiar, I'm sure, to all of you. This is the original version. I'd like to go beyond the British abroad and consider the Grand Tour in a wider sense, involving travelers from many countries and destinations that included leading musical centers such as London and Vienna. In other words, I'm now going to consider the Grand Tour not just as involving the ultimate destination of Italy. An early Grand Tour in which music played a crucial role was that of Friedrich von Uffenbach, a young law student and amateur musician from Frankfurt. Uffenbach loved instrumental music as much as opera. He traveled in Switzerland, Italy, and France in 1714 to 1716. And recorded his itinerary and impressions in a diary. Starting in Strasbourg, where he had studied at the university, he ascended the Rhine Valley to Basel, then crossed Switzerland into Italy, crossed northern Italy from west to east, heading for Venice, then south to Rome and Naples. Heading back north, he crossed into France, there's Naples, and spent some time in Geneva, and then went to Paris, where he stayed for 8 months taking lute lessons and attending the opera. The last leg of his grand tour took him back to his native city of Frankfurt by way of the Netherlands. Like the Duke of Leeds 15 years later, and many other tourists, Uffenbach timed his trip so as to arrive in Venice during Carnival. He attended a masked ball and several operas, during one of which Antonio Vivaldi astonished him with the performance of a cadenza for solo violin. His account is particularly valuable because it referred to music that Vivaldi did not necessarily write down. So I quote from the diary, February 4th, 1715. Went with several acquaintances to the Sant'Angelo Theater. The manager of this theater is the famous Vivaldi, who was also the composer of the opera, which was very good indeed and a fine spectacle too. The machines, however, were not as sumptuous as those in the other theater, and the orchestra was not as large, but well worth hearing nonetheless. Towards the end, Vivaldi played an admirable solo to accompany an aria, at the conclusion of which he added an improvisation that really frightened me, for I doubt anything like it was ever done before or will ever be again. He came to within a hair's breadth of the bridge, leaving no room for the bow, and this on all four strings, with imitations and incredible speed. He astonished everyone with this, although to say it touched me would not be true, because it was not as agreeable to listen to as it was cunningly contrived. For an idea of the kind of aria with obbligato violin that Uffenbach might have heard Vivaldi play, here is part of the aria Sovente il Sole from Vivaldi's Andromeda. Oh, I should have moved the slide here. Here's Vivaldi, and yeah, you have the text of this aria, which goes on for about 10 minutes. We'll just hear a short excerpt. As I quote further from Uffenbach's diary, you'll hear that he actually developed a personal relationship with the composer. March 6, 1715, Vivaldi, the famous composer and violin player, came to see me, for I had repeatedly left word at his house requesting him to do so. I had spoken of certain concerti grossi, which I wished to obtain, and had ordered them from him, but I had also sent him, since he belongs to the musical tribe, several bottles of wine. And so he let me hear his very difficult and quite inimitable improvisations on the violin, and I was compelled to admire his dexterity the more at close quarters, although I saw quite clearly that while he played extra difficult and colorful things, he did so with no great charm and tunefulness. So obviously his opinions are a little bit mixed. March 9th, 1715, he writes, Vivaldi came to see me this afternoon and brought me what I had ordered, namely 10 concerti grossi, some of which, as he said, he had composed expressly for me. And so that I might hear them better, he wished to teach them to me at once and come to see me from time to time. And we made a beginning today. Unfortunately, he left Venice shortly thereafter, so his lessons with Vivaldi didn't go on for perhaps more than one session. From Venice, Uffenbach traveled on to Rome, where he could not enjoy opera because Carnival had ended. But Lent was hardly a total loss from a musical point of view. As in many parts of Catholic Europe, musicians in Rome used the closing of theaters as an opportunity to present concerts. At the palace of a prominent patron of music, Uffenbach witnessed the performance of an oratorio by Antonio Caldara. And I quote again from the diary. In the evening was the great weekly concert in the palace of Prince Rospoli, which, because of the many expenses that he annually allots to it, is the best here. And since he welcomes and permits every foreigner to come in without introduction, we therefore went there together and were led through a large number of exquisitely furnished rooms to an enormously large and long hall in which, as in the entire house, there is no lack of incomparable paintings and silver work. Everything was most brilliantly illuminated, and on both sides of the hall, chairs were placed for the listeners. Above, however, the place for musicians was left free, where a great number of virtuosos arranged themselves, and three female singers, next to a small castrato, sat in front. They then gave an excellent concert, or so-called oratorio, that I was completely delighted. The composition is completely new each time and is composed by the well-known Caldara, papal maestro di cappella, who also conducted here. People listened to the excellent voices so attentively that not a fly stirred. At about the middle of the concert, they had an intermission, and then liquors, frozen things, confectionery, and coffee were brought around in quantity and presented to everyone. Afterward was performed the second half of the concert, which lasted altogether 4 hours. I would have remained even 14 days with great pleasure, for I certainly left with genuine astonishment. I have never in my life heard anything to compare with this. In the accompaniment, there was a violin that was unusually well played and many other instruments, all played to perfection. It was midnight when we were finished, but sleep did not hinder me from listening to it all to the end with the greatest pleasure. The oratorio by Caldara, performed on this occasion, Abisai, has not been recorded. But an aria from another of Caldara's oratorios gives us a sense of how he could have delighted the audience that included Uffenbach. Thank you. completely different kind of grand tour, but again involving amateur musicians, took place 65 years after Uffenbach's tour. From September 1781 to October 1782, Grand Duke Paul and his wife, Grand Duchess Maria Feodorovna, toured Europe. Paul was the son of Empress Catherine the Great of Russia and heir to the imperial throne. Maria, whom you see in this slide, was a princess of Württemberg, one of the many small principalities into which much of German-speaking Europe was divided. Despite traveling incognito as the Count and Countess of the North, all of Europe knew who they were, and each city they visited treated them as celebrities. Both the Grand Duke and Duchess were passionately fond of music and theater. It was natural that opera and instrumental music should play a crucial role in the festivities with which they were welcomed wherever they went. Moreover, the interest that the voyage inspired means that it was documented in great detail. A synthesis of contemporary reports of the voyage comes quite close to constituting an account of the state of music in Europe in the early 1780s, which is, of course, a decade of great significance in the history of music. So it's worth examining this grand tour in some detail. First, a quick survey of the trip. Leaving St. Petersburg in September 1781, the Grand Duke and Duchess traveled quickly southwest, heading by way of Berlin to Vienna, which was their first big stop. This was they were in Vienna for the entire month of December 1781. In early January 1782, they continued south, arriving at their second major destination, Venice, right in time for Carnival, which continued during their brief visit to Rome and several busy weeks in Naples. Heading back north, they stopped a few days in Florence and then continued through northern Italy to Turin and across the Alps to Switzerland and France. They spent about a month in Paris and Versailles and then traveled on through the Loire Valley and Brittany and Normandy, north to the Netherlands and east to Germany. Their final major destination was Stuttgart, which was the capital of Württemberg, the Grand Duchess's homeland. This was a kind of, this final tour, the final stop was a homecoming for the Grand Duchess. After a brief second visit to Vienna, the Grand Ducal couple headed home to Russia. They returned to St. Petersburg 13 months after they had left it. Venice had several months to prepare for the visit. Mozart, newly settled in the Habsburg capital, hoped that Die Entführung aus dem Serail might be performed for the first time for the Russian dignitaries. But Emperor Joseph II preferred to mark the visit with a retrospective celebration of the operatic achievements of Christoph Gluck. Performances of Orfeo ed Euridice, Alceste, and Iphigenie en Tauride were all given during the visit of the Grand Duke and Duchess. Among the many dramatic high points of these operas, the Russians could have admired the wonderful moment in Alceste when an oracle announces the only way to save the life of King Admetus. King Admetus is dying. This is loud enough. Sento segni espressi già presente più la palmo. Thank you. are here. Although Die Entführung aus dem Serail had to wait for its premiere until the following summer, Joseph made good use of Mozart's talents during the Grand Ducal visit. He arranged for Mozart and the visiting pianist Muzio Clementi to compete in a pianistic duel. Mozart described the event to his father. Clementi is an excellent keyboard player, but that is all. He has great facility with his right hand. His star passages are parallel thirds. Apart from this, he has not a bit of taste or feeling. He is a mere technician. After we had stood on ceremony long enough, the emperor declared that Clementi ought to begin. La Santa Chiesa Cattolica, he said, Clementi being a Roman. He improvised and then played a sonata. The emperor then turned to me. Allons, fire away. I improvised and played variations. The Grand Duchess produced some sonatas by Paisiello. Paisiello was the maestro di cappella at the court of St. Petersburg and Maria Feodorovna's music teacher. But Mozart says that these sonatas were wretchedly written out in his own hand, of which I had to play the allegros and Clementi the andantes and rondos. We then selected a theme from them and developed it on two pianos. The sonata that Clementi played was later published as Opus 24, number 2. Mozart may have remembered it when, 10 years later, he wrote the overture to the Magic Flute. Thank you. It was just the exposition. The Russians had another musical treat in store 2 days later. According to an article in a local paper, the Pressburger Zeitung, the Emperor and Archduke Maximilian attended a grand concert on 26 December in the chambers of the Countess of the North. The author, Verfasser of it, was Prince Esterhazy's Kapellmeister, the famous Haydn. At this occasion was presented a quartet played by Luigi Tomasini, Aspelmeyer, Weigl, and Huber. The illustrious company honored it not only with their gracious applause, but also bestowed on Haydn as composer a magnificent enameled box studded with diamonds. The four other artists named received a golden snuff box apiece. The musicians Haydn brought together on this occasion consisted of two of his colleagues at the Esterhazy Kapelle, that is the violinists Tomasini and the cellist, Weigl, and two Viennese musicians, the violinist Aspelmeyer and the violist Huber. They presumably played music soon to be published in an edition dedicated to the Grand Duke of Russia as Haydn's celebrated Opus 33. A single quartet was probably not enough to fill a grand concert, for which the participants received such rich rewards. The author of the report quoted above might have meant, when he wrote quartetto, he might have meant, or might have used the term in the sense of an ensemble that played several of Haydn's new quartets, perhaps even all six. If so, then the Grand Duke and Duchess rewarded Haydn and his players, in part, for the famous finale of what later came to be called the Joke Quartet. Thank you. Moving to the next major stop on the Grand Ducal Tour, Venice. Among the musical high points of the visit was a banquet and a ball given at one of the city's largest theaters, the Teatro San Benedetto. The floor of the auditorium was cleared of benches so it could be used for dancing. A staircase linked the dance floor with the stage on which the Russians and their hosts enjoyed a banquet. The orchestra on two levels and both sides of the stairs accompanied both dancing and dining. On another evening, the Russians were treated to a concert by the combined forces of several of the famous Venetian ospedali, the institutions that had their origins as orphanages, but by the 18th century had evolved into musical conservatories for girls and young women. According to a published report published soon after the event, the illustrious travelers were given an entertainment unobtainable anywhere except Venice. 100 girls from the several conservatories, dressed in black uniforms appropriate to their status, performed a cantata for several voices interspersed with choruses. It was accompanied by instruments of every sort, and the only man among them was the composer of the music. The Russians continued south, to Rome, where they had spent just enough time to see some of the main sites, such as the Pantheon, St. Peter's, the Capitoline, the Colosseum, and to attend operas at the Teatro Argentina and the Teatro Valle. They moved on to to Naples, where they stayed for the rest of Carnival, attending many events that involved music. Operas and ballets at San Carlo, concerts, balls, and gala dinners. We saw earlier how Offenbach had enjoyed music in Rome despite the closing of theaters during Lent. The Russians likewise continued to experience Italy's musical treasures during the penitential season. On their way north from Naples, they stopped for several days in the capital of Tuscany, Florence. Tuscany was ruled by Grand Duke Leopold, who was the brother of Emperor Joseph II. Leopold celebrated the Russians' arrival in Florence during Lent with concert performances of two operas in the city's principal theater. In describing the first of these concerts, the Gazzetta Toscana, the local paper, noted that the opera's librettist had enjoyed the patronage of the Russian court, implying that this made the choice of opera particularly appropriate. And the opera in question was Tommaso Traetta's Iphigenia in Tauride, which had been first performed in Venice in 1763 as part of a series of innovative Italian operas that made heavy use of chorus, a series to which Gluck's Orfeo and Alceste also belonged. As I mentioned earlier, Emperor Joseph had marked the visit of the Russians to Vienna with the performance of operas by Gluck, including Orfeo and Alceste. Leopold, fully aware of how his brother had treated the Grand Duke and Duchess in Vienna, did not allow the restrictions of Lent to keep him from giving them an equally splendid musical feast in Florence, and one that projected many of the same musical and theatrical values. In other words, I think this is probably this performance of this opera, Traetta's opera in Florence was an act of sibling rivalry in some sense. The Russians continued north, enjoying, among other events, a performance at the Teatro Reggio I should have showed you this picture of another painting by Battoni, this one of Emperor Joseph and his brother Leopold. And there's the Teatro Reggio in Turin. They crossed the Alps into Paris, and at Versailles and Paris, they enjoyed the hospitality of Queen Marie Antoinette, which involved the presentation of many theatrical events. The instrumental virtuosos who played for the Russians included the celebrated violinist Giovanni Battista Viotti. Opera companies included the venerable Académie Royale de Musique, founded by Louis XIV, which presented, among many other works, François-Joseph Gossec's brand new opera, Thésée, of which I have here's the final musical excerpt for you. This is an opera that I bet none of you have heard before. I hate to cut it off, but it's we're running out of time. So I'd like to end by briefly considering some of the tours of professional musicians. So, for example, one was the flutist Johann Joachim Kvantz, a prolific composer and the flute teacher of Frederick the Great of Prussia, most famous today as the author of a very important treatise on flute playing. Kvantz was already a well-established musician in Dresden when he spent the years 1724 to 1727 traveling through Europe. And here is his trip, starting in Dresden, down to Venice, down through Rome to Naples, the same tour that so many other people, the same itinerary that so many others took, Paris, and then London, which was pretty unusual for a musician from the continent. Witnessed performance of several operas by Handel in London. No professional musician benefited more from travel than Mozart, and we can't really talk about the grand tour in music without at least mentioning Mozart's grand tour. The primary motive of his father, Leopold, in organizing the tour that he and his family made in 1763 to 1766 was to make money from the performances of his two prodigious children. But the trip to Germany, from Salzburg through Germany to Belgium, to Paris, London, the Netherlands, back to Paris, Lyon, through Switzerland, back to Salzburg, it also benefited the children by exposing them to the languages, customs, and musical styles of Europe's cities and courts. Even in an age of frequent international travel, Charles Burney's two trips are remarkable for the vast distances he covered, the number of places he visited, and the importance of the musicians he heard and met. Here's Charles Burney. Here's the itinerary of his first trip, which was really pretty to Italy and followed the itinerary that many other British tourists took, down to Naples. Much more unusual was his second trip. That was 1770. Then 1772, he toured the German-speaking part of Europe, to Vienna, Berlin, and back to London. The lively accounts of these journeys that he published on his return to London constitute the successful marriage of two kinds of travel, of writing, typical of the 18th century, travel books and music criticism. Let me end with, on a somewhat wistful note, with the words of a composer who never made the grand tour. Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach wrote in his memoirs with a mixture of defensiveness and regret that testifies to the importance of travel in 18th century musical life. This lack of foreign travel would have been more disadvantageous to me in my profession if I had not had the special good fortune since my youth to hear close by the finest of all kinds of music and to make a great many acquaintances among masters of the first rank, sometimes winning their friendship. Yet, I do not deny that it would have been of exceptional pleasure as well as advantage to me if I could have had the opportunity to visit foreign lands. Thank you for your attention and patience. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Rice, for a very enjoyable and colorful talk on such a gray day. I did wonder if you might consider adding Lady Mary Wortley Montague to your list of enthusiastic amateur musicians. I'm sure you know her letters. She's gotten, unfortunately, in musicological circles, a lot more attention, I think, for her fraught relationship with opera critic Francesco Algarotti than for her other musical activities, but there's a lovely letter about her borrowing a harpsichord from Alexander Pope, and of course her descriptions of music around the Mediterranean, because of course she went to Turkey as well as some of the usual grand tour spots.
Yes. So, thank you for bringing her up. Of course, the major challenge in this kind of presentation is that there's so much material and so many fascinating people who took trips in the 18th century, but she's certainly one of the most important, especially for what she tells us about music in the early 18th century.
Well, no, I think Professor Ray's suggestion that we mix it up a little bit in the back and then talk to Professor Rice informally. Thanks once again for
Thank you.